Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with Beans. Today is part two of Missouri v. Biden. We're going to be going over the second, quote, half, I guess, of the Missouri v. Biden case. In case you missed Monday's show, you can always find it. You can find it on all the streaming platforms. You can find it on all the podcasting platforms. Go back and listen to it so that you're up to speed. But just to recap quickly for everybody, the Missouri v. Biden case is one of the most important civil liberties cases in our lifetime. It has to do with whether or not the government is allowed to coerce social media to censor American speech based on what they consider are disfavored viewpoints. That is the case in a nutshell. We went through the case on Monday, starting from the beginning with the complaint and everything that happened from the complaint up until just about when they were about to take depositions from some of the people. So basically, the states of Missouri and Louisiana, and then later some independent plaintiffs, petitioned the court for a preliminary injunction and expedited discovery to determine the preliminary injunction to temporarily halt the government from communicating with social media platforms to censor Americans while the rest of this case travels on through the court system. And there were, the judge in this case is an absolute patriot, an amazing guy. I know the word patriot's overused, but he is. And he has granted basically every motion to try and stifle the government from doing what they're doing, because it's very clear, based on the discovery we've received so far and the information we have, that the government is absolutely coercing social media by threat to censor Americans on every single topic you can think of, straight up, or else legislation will be filed, or else you'll lose your Section 230 protection, or else. So we got to the point where the government was asking, the depositions were all granted, the Fifth Circuit was, they filed at the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit came back to the judge. The Fifth Circuit is the court of appeal that is above this case. They went back to the judge and said, listen, some of these people are really important department heads. Could you guys reevaluate and see if you can speak to somebody below them? They did all that. Everybody's all set to go. And then the government starts pulling shenanigans. We want to stay these depositions because we have this problem, and this problem. We want this. We want that. We want this. And we want them filed on the docket under a protective order because we don't want Americans to be able to see them. They use the argument that if Americans were able to see the depositions that were taken and read the depositions that were taken, the people who gave the depositions would be in harm's way somehow. And you have to think about this. How could that be possible if they didn't do anything wrong? Like, if these people weren't saying things that were wrong and false and lies, who would want to attack them? Why would they be concerned about that? So the judge had this motion in front of him to quash all of it, or not quash, to put all of this up on the docket under protective order, under seal, not available to the public. The judge basically said, too bad, so sad, we'll redact personal, like PII, personal identifying information, addresses, email addresses, things like that. But that's it. No FBI, we're not redacting anybody's name. No, CISA, we're not redacting, you know, how you've run the biggest censorship operation in our country's history. It's going out there for everybody to see, okay? So that's where we left off. Now, where we are today is we're going to start off with Jen Psaki. So Jen Psaki was the press secretary and was directly responsible for making threats to social media companies from the bully pulpit. And everybody that, so what they'll typically do is, this lawsuit sues the office, not the individual. So it sues the press office, it sues the White House, it sues the DHS, it sues the, you know, CISA. It doesn't sue the person running CISA in their individual capacity. It sues the office. So what the government will often do, and we'll get to in just a minute, is substitute people in and out of those offices whenever they get into a, you know, a hairy situation, because then the person can have plausible deniability and say, I have no idea why that happened. I wasn't here. Okay. So what happened was Jen Psaki left. Karine Jean-Pierre came in. They denied having any information, written or otherwise, about whether or not why Jen Psaki said the things she said directly about the disinformation. Doesn't, if you recall, she stood up there and she basically, I wonder if I can find it. She stood up there and she basically told the disinformation dozen that they should be banned across all platforms, and she doesn't know why they're not banned across all platforms. Let me see if I can grab a clip for you real quick. Here. Here she is, as Citizen Free Press calls her, Peppermint Commie. Here we go.
I went through kind of the top line details of this yesterday, but can you elaborate a little bit on the Facebook, the administration to Facebook flagging of disinformation? And then there's also some reporting that we've had that Facebook maybe hasn't been as proactive as the White House would like it to be in response to some of the flagging. So the process of how the flagging works, and then whether Facebook has been amenable to those requests.
Sure. Well, I would say first, it shouldn't come as any surprise that we're in regular touch with social media platforms, just like we're in regular touch with all of you and your media outlets about areas where we have concern, information that might be useful, information that may or may not be interesting to your viewers. You all make decisions just like the social media platforms make decisions, even though they're a private sector company and different, but just as an example. So we are regularly making sure social media platforms are aware of the latest narratives dangerous to public health that we and many other Americans are seeing across all of social and traditional media.
Has been as proactive as the White House would like in terms of its response to those flags?
Well, I think as I noted yesterday, Phil, there are more steps that everyone can take. And I would just note again, this is a responsibility of officials speaking, of course, on behalf of the government. It's a responsibility.
So she goes into it here, 5 minutes of it, but the fact that they even argued for a second, they didn't have anything written to provide when she's reading from prepared notes, is clearly a lie. Anyway, long story short, they ended up saying, we need to talk to Jen Psaki because she's the only one with any information on this. And Jen Psaki, her attorneys, she had Jeannie Rhee, if you know that name, defending her. She took it to like six different courts. Not six, but you know what I'm saying. And was trying to get this deposition quashed. She brought it to Virginia. And the Virginia judge basically, I read this whole transcript out into a video because it was so crazy. The Virginia, the DC judge, for lack of a better descriptor, basically told her, I don't know why you're here. How dare you ask me to intervene above this other judge when he's ordering something? I'm not going to rule the way you want. I'm sending it back to him. You need to sit down and testify. Long story short, I think they were able to weasel out what they wanted from Jen Psaki and or the government without having Jen Psaki testify, because that he ordered her to testify. He ordered the deposition to happen. The timeline was set. They tried every which way from Sunday to try and stop Jen Psaki from testifying. And here is some of the order in the reconsideration that the Fifth Circuit asked the judge to do. After considering the arguments of plaintiffs and federal defendants, this court finds there is no suitable alternative for Rob Flaherty. Rob Flaherty ended up being the man at the White House, and they really wanted to stop him from having to answer questions or respond to written interrogatories, but they couldn't. However, because written discovery would be less intrusive than a deposition, it's authorized that written discovery be served on Flaherty, such as interrogatories and requests for production of documents, rather than a deposition. Within 5 days from this order, plaintiffs shall serve upon Flaherty interrogatories and requests for production of documents. Flaherty shall provide his answers by January 5th, 2023. At the request of federal defendants, the deadline for expedited preliminary injunction-related discovery is extended from December 31st to January 13th. Now, I don't know how expedited we are anymore. And yes, Yoma in the chat is saying, did she imply that media businesses are not private? I caught that too. She says, unlike you, it was very, very interesting. I caught that too. I just didn't want to get sidetracked on it, but good ears, good listening. Yes, she did. For those of you wondering, it was in the beginning of this clip. I'll put the clip in the show notes where she says this. Good listening. Good ears, Yoma. So anyway, they get through all of that. They get the depositions. And then they realize after they depose Brian Scully from CISA, who was the person they substituted in for Jen Easterly, they realize that CISA is withholding information. CISA's withholding information from them, and they know that because Brian Scully coughs up the name of four interns that were working for both CISA and the Stanford Internet Observatory, a private company that the government, private business, private institution, NGO, that the government contracted with to censor when even they felt it was just too much for them to do. Now, that's saying something, given what we've seen here. However, he coughs up these names, and the plaintiffs, Missouri and Louisiana, and the private plaintiffs are like, wait a second. We don't know who these people are. We haven't gotten anything from these people. Clearly, they're involved. Scully said their names. And so they file with the court, and they file a memorandum and a motion to compel more disclosures from CISA. And this is the first paragraph. The court should order defendant CISA to supplement its document production to include a responsive document. Oh, it's five, sorry. From five current and former CISA officials, and he names them. It emerged during Brian Scully's deposition last Thursday that these five officials are or have directly engaged in routing reports of so-called disinformation from government officials to social media platforms for censorship, or what they call switchboarding. As plaintiff's discovery requests clearly and explicitly requested these very communications, yet CISA failed to search the ESI of these five officials or produce any responsive documents from them. On the contrary, CISA's interrogatory responses implied that it had made a good faith determination that these officials were not among those having relevant information, when in fact, the opposite is true. And they go through the case, 16 pages worth, of why this happened, how it happened, the details of it. CISA concealed the five custodians' involvement in switchboarding. CISA contends its document production revealed that those four custodians had some level of involvement in CISA's switchboarding efforts, but CISA switchboarding is not, well, they're claiming CISA switchboarding is defunct now, so it doesn't matter anymore. CISA is saying, we don't do this anymore, so it doesn't matter. It's not relevant because it's done. And plaintiffs are saying the switchboarding isn't defunct and it's highly relevant, which it is, and it's still ongoing. It's just changed its name. Long story short, they go through all of this and the judge rules. Pending before the court is a motion to compel supplemental disclosures from defendant CISA. For the following reasons, plaintiff's motion to compel those disclosures is granted. Again, the judge says, how dare you? What are you doing? Produce those documents or else. And just so you guys know, I have a whole timeline of this case on my X profile as well, in case you want it. This is the background. Let's just read it out. On May 5th, plaintiffs filed a complaint alleging federal defendants colluded or coerced social media companies to suppress disfavored speakers, viewpoints, etc., by labeling content dismiss and malinformation. On June 14th, plaintiffs filed a motion for preliminary injunction. On June 17th, plaintiffs filed a motion for expedited preliminary injunction. They granted the motion. As part of that, they were granted injunction-related discovery. On August 17, 2022, CISA and Easterly served responses which identified custodians of social information and contact-attached communications. On January 12, 2023, the deposition of Brian Scully was taken by plaintiffs. In the deposition, Scully listed the following five additional people. After that, counsel for plaintiffs made a request on the record that CISA and Easterly supplement their previous answers to include information from the people identified. It was followed up on, and CISA and Easterly continued to deny that they're entitled to this information because it's not timely, it's not relevant to the plaintiffs, and plaintiffs have already gotten it. Then the judge goes on to literally dissect and destroy CISA. It is ordered that CISA shall supplement their answers and requests. It is ordered that in accordance with the previous briefing schedule, plaintiffs have 30 days from the expiration of the preliminary injunction-related discovery to file a supplemental request because CISA said they waited too long. This judge is just tops. Just tops. Then some time goes by, and on March 7th, the plaintiffs in this case file a 364-page finding of fact. This is all of the information that they gathered up in discovery, everything they got from their depositions, everything they've gotten from the social media companies, everything they've gotten from the government's production to them. It is, again, 364 pages long. It is really something else. Could I read through this whole thing with you? Yeah, I could. But it's 364 pages long. In coupling with that, they filed their motion for preliminary injunction, stating their case. That is 79 pages long. All the reasons why the injunction should be granted, whether or not they would be likely to succeed on the merits, whether or not this case would win, etc., so on and so forth. And I'll read the introduction in part. This case involves some of the most egregious First Amendment violations in American history. Federal officials from the White House and multiple agencies use pressure, threats, coercion, cajoling, collusion, demands, trickery, and deceit to induce social media platforms to censor speakers and viewpoints on social media that the federal officials disfavor. The proof of this sprawling federal censorship enterprise is voluminous and overwhelming. Plaintiffs summarize key points of the evidence in 1,442 numbered paragraphs with specific citations of the record for each point, meaning that every single thing they cite in those 1,442 numbered paragraphs in 300 and something pages is cited with evidence that is in the record and is kind of indisputable, guys. It's evidence-backed because they had discovery. White House officials like Rob Flaherty. This evidence establishes beyond dispute the following unconscionable federal censorship activities. Here we go. White House officials like Rob Flaherty, Andrew Slavitt, and Jen Psaki have engaged in a relentless pressure campaign, both in public and private, to coerce platforms into censoring disfavored viewpoints on social media. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy and his staff coordinate closely with the White House in this pressure campaign, causing social media platforms to scramble and assure federal officials that we hear your call to do more to censor disfavored viewpoints. The CDC flags specific social media posts for censorship, organizes Be on the Lookout meetings to tell platforms what should be censored, and serves as the ultimate fact checker with final authority to dictate what speech should be removed from social media. The FBI deliberately planted false information about hack and leak operations to deceive social media platforms into censoring the Hunter Biden laptop story. The FBI, CISA, and GEC collude with social media platforms in hundreds of meetings about misinformation, and those agencies repeatedly flag huge quantities of First Amendment-protected speech to platforms for censorship. CISA switchboards reports of so-called misinformation from state and local governments to platforms for censorship. CISA and the GEC are pervasively intertwined with massive public-private censorship enterprises like EIP, which is an NGO. Altogether, these censorship activities by federal officials and agencies constitute a gargantuan federal censorship enterprise. It is highly effective. It has stifled debate and criticism of government policy on social media about some of the most pressing issues of our time. And its activities are flagrantly unconstitutional. Some of the things that Rob Flaherty in particular forced the social media companies to censor. Just to give you an example of one that is particularly egregious, on Facebook, there were groups that formed for vaccine injured people. There were people speaking out about things that they went through after getting the vaccine. Rob Flaherty berated and cursed and screamed at Facebook via email. I mean, it's like a battered wife. He was treating Facebook like he was their boss, and it was a battered wife syndrome. I have an article from Uncovered DC with the top 13, I think it is, things that have come out in the case regarding censorship and what they did. Rob Flaherty demanded Facebook remove any smidgen of content that spoke poorly of the vaccines at all. And if they didn't remove it, they basically just put this person, whoever it was talking about the stuff that's happening to them, in a box where no one else could see what they were saying. They disbanded groups of people that had gotten together for some fellowship and community surrounding their experiences. Facebook said all along via email, this is not a good idea. It doesn't break our terms of service. It's just going to cause a bigger problem. These people need to have a place that they can talk. The opposite is going to end up happening if you continue to force us to do this. And Flaherty was having none of it. They ended up taking action, even though they didn't want to. And it's very clear. I'm not saying Facebook is a bunch of good guys, but I am saying that they did not want to remove this content. Other things, Tucker Carlson video about the J&J shots causing blood clots, that was removed after days of being up there because the White House said so. People making fun of Jill Biden. One of the most serendipitous things that happened was they forced Instagram to create a new algorithm to remove vaccine hesitant content that they consider to be vaccine hesitant or promote vaccine hesitancy. And all of a sudden, like, I guess Biden's engagement went down significantly. So Rob Flaherty calls up Meta and says, hey, you know, we're noticing very little interaction with our account on Instagram. Can you guys look into this and figure out what's going on? It's very weird. They look into it. They get back to Flaherty and they say, okay, we fixed it. We're really sorry about that. And Flaherty, like, wants to know why. He's, like, cursing at them in email. Why? Why did this happen? You guys are effing inept, blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out that the algorithm they created to remove content that was seen, could be seen as vaccine hesitant, was so specific, it removed all vaccine-related content. And shadow banned any user talking about vaccines in any way whatsoever. So Joe Biden, who was livid, his office was livid about the censorship, was caught up in the very censorship machine he was doling out to the general public. And I am so, I am really okay with conversations in the chat, guys. I really am. But for today, for this topic, if you could keep it topic centric, I'd appreciate it. Because this is too important to be talking about other stuff. You can find a way to DM each other if you want. But I want to be able to see questions that people are asking. And I can't because we're talking about the CIA and the Kasarians. I don't know who they are. But I don't know if there are any questions coming in. So they file this. Obviously, the government files. First of all, they file back saying to the judge, we're putting a motion to strike on the proposed findings or fact, a fact that the plaintiffs put in. We can't respond to this. It's too long and too detailed. There's no way we'd be able to respond, and they have to ask permission. So we want it to be taken out of the record altogether. And they don't really give a response. The judge responds to them by allowing them some more time to answer it. The plaintiffs respond to their motion to strike and say this: the reason why they don't want this in the record is because it's devastating to them. Absolutely devastating. And for no other reason. That motion is 24 pages long. It's got a lot of information in it. I'm trying to keep this as, you know, high level as I can without getting into too much of the details. Nanette Law in the comments asks, can we as citizens sue this clown for violating our constitutional rights? I'm going to get to something in a minute that's going to answer that question because it's a very good one. The judge comes back and tells the government, no, your motion to strike is denied. I'll give you a little more time to respond, but no, the motion to strike is denied. Then the judge on March 20th rules on the motion to dismiss. The government motion to dismiss on the case for a million different reasons, standing, all different kinds of stuff, whether or not Missouri and Louisiana can sue, whether or not there's any case, whether or not the government's protected. Well, the judge in this case comes back and says, nope, case continues, motion to dismiss denied. Ronan, great question. So the motion to dismiss is denied. The findings of fact are entered into the record. The government is beside themselves at this point. And then to everybody in the audience who's asking these brilliant questions, point. The plaintiffs, Missouri and Louisiana, move to amend the complaint to add a class allegation and make it a class action. For reasons stated in the memorandum filed contemporaneously, plaintiffs respectively moved the court for leave to amend their complaint to add class allegations and for class certification. The third amended complaint is attached and they file for class. On May 9th, I want to say, of 2023, the hearing on the temporary injunction happened in Louisiana, and I went. I physically traveled there thanks to the help of you guys in the audience and a donor that came forward to fund my trip there. It was something else. I sat in this hearing. It was about 8 hours long, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Judge Doty asked brilliant questions. The transcript of this hearing is 190 pages long and is available for everybody to download and read. But I wanted to pull up this one certain section that I think everybody in the courtroom gasped when this section was going on. And I wanted to read it to you guys real quick. The court says, the judge says, I'm going to make some statements. And you tell me, the government, whether you think it's protected free speech or not. So the judge is going to make a statement and ask the government to respond with whether or not the statement the judge made is protected free speech under the First Amendment to the Constitution. The first statement the judge made was this: the COVID vaccine does not work. And here is Mr. Gardner, who is the attorney on the government side. He's actually a deputy attorney general. Just, I'm telling you this for a reason. Mr. Gardner says, so again, I'm going to try and answer your question as directly as possible. But the whole question here is whether there was undue coercion or significant encouragement such that the government's relationships with social media companies resulted in a First Amendment violation. And the judge says, and I do understand that y'all, I'm going to ask some questions about that. I'm not asking you to admit that you did anything and are these free speech. I'm just asking you, is this protected free speech? The statement, does the COVID vaccine does not work? And Mr. Gardner, the Deputy Attorney General, says, well, understood, Your Honor. That statement standing alone, depending on who the speaker is, could be protected by the First Amendment. Could be. Could be. And the judge says, could be? Yeah, so for example, and the court says, could it not be? Is there anything you could see at all that the COVID vaccine does not work, that that's not protected free speech? And the DOJ says, yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. Let's say it was spoken by a covert Russian operative. That would not be protected by free speech. And plaintiffs acknowledge that. Now, what plaintiffs say is that liking that statement may have First Amendment implications. And the court says, all right, and this was like during COVID. I don't even know if the Russians were involved in that or not, but I know you all said in the elections. All right, well, how about this? Masks don't work to stop COVID from spreading. The DOJ says the same response. It could be protected free speech, depending on who the speaker is. The court says, all right, and let me just assume they're American citizens making those statements, okay? We're going to assume it's American citizens making these statements, not Russian operatives. It's ridiculous. The 2020 election was stolen. Mr. Gardner, is that protected free speech? So again, if it came from an American citizen, then that speech itself could be protected. But again, it doesn't answer the question of whether there's a First Amendment violation. Could be protected. You hear, this is the DOJ. I was sitting there in this hearing with my mouth like that, listening to this attorney, this deputy attorney general for the United States Department of Justice, saying that an American citizen proclaiming that the 2020 election was stolen may not be protected First Amendment speech. The judge was just as incredulous as I was. I actually made eye contact with him. He saw me. I was sitting right in front of him. Here we go. So again, the court says, tell me how that statement could not be protected. What possibly could go wrong with that statement that it's not free speech? And Gardner says, the DOJ, if it came from, for example, a Russian, a covert foreign operative like a Russian government, the courts say, okay, let's move on. Climate change is a hoax. Gardner says, same response. And then the court says, President Biden is responsible for inflation and high gas prices. Same response. And then the court says, all right, okay. And I just want to kind of, you know, go through what free speech was. And I'm not assuming that you admit that there's significant encouragement or coercion, but I did want to ask the question to both sides. Do you agree that the test for determining whether the government is responsible for another private company's decisions is whether there's coercion and or significant encouragement? And the DOJ says, yeah, that's the test the Supreme Court's recognized. Actually, says now the plaintiff's attorney pipes up and says, actually, that's one of multiple tests because there's also joint participation and conspiracy or collusion. And so I'd point out that the test is actually two different things because the case law makes clear that there's coercion and then significant encouragement that falls short of coercion still counts. Now, there was one other part of this that I have to find in this section where, here we go. What page are we on here? Bear with me. Bear with me a second, because there is a portion in here where this attorney for the DOJ argues that an American who speaks on a topic unwittingly on behalf of, without knowing that the person that they're quote tweeting or resharing is a member of a foreign country could be guilty of FARA. And
I basically couldn't believe what I was reading when I saw what I was hearing when I heard this. This entire portion of the argument here with Gardner was really something else. Here we go. I'm going to find it and bring it up on Friday for you guys because I don't want to waste too much time on this. But seriously, it was something else. I couldn't believe they were invoking FARA against American citizens talking on social media as a justification for them being able to censor. So we get through that hearing. We get through it. I interviewed the solicitors of Missouri and Louisiana. I provided a transcript to that interview. And on May 1st, the federal government files a substitution notice. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, like 50 people were moved out of departments and into new ones, or out of departments and out of government altogether, that were involved in this case. And then on June 16th, the government files a notice that Rob Flaherty is gone as of June 30th. He won't be employed in any capacity by the U.S. government anymore after what he had provided and done in this case. They remove him. He goes to work on the Biden campaign, but they get rid of him. And then, as I am sitting and enjoying a drink with my family at a July 4th barbecue, the judge in this case releases his ruling on the preliminary injunction. On the 4th of July, the introduction reads, "I may disapprove of what you say, but I would defend to the death your right to say it. This case is about," this is the judge, "this case is about the free speech clause in the First Amendment to the Constitution. The explosion of social media platforms has resulted in unique free speech issues, and this is especially true in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. If the allegations made by plaintiffs are true, the present case arguably involves the most massive attack against free speech in United States history. In their attempts to suppress alleged disinformation, the federal government, and particularly the defendants named here, are alleged to have blatantly ignored the First Amendment right to free speech. Although the censorship alleged in this case almost exclusively targeted conservative speech, the issues raised herein go beyond party lines. The right to free speech is not a member of any political party and doesn't hold any political ideology. It's the purpose of the free speech clause of the First Amendment to preserve an uninhibited marketplace of ideas in which truth will ultimately prevail, rather than to countenance monopolization of the market, whether it be by the government itself or by private license. Plaintiffs allege that defendants, through public pressure campaigns, private meetings, and other forms of direct communication regarding what defendants described as disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation, have colluded with and/or coerced social media platforms to suppress disfavored speakers' viewpoints and content on social media. The judge ultimately rules in favor of the plaintiffs, grants the motion and the preliminary injunction. Says it's akin to Orwell in 1984, what he's seeing. Talks in detail in 155-page order. 155 pages of an order. A memorandum on order. Goes through the factual record in explicit detail. And rules in favor of the United States citizen that yes, there should be a preliminary injunction granted right now to stop the government from doing this throughout the rest of this trial until it can go before a jury and a determination can be made. The judgment is very specific. It has a carve out in it, okay? All of the people, all the plaintiffs listed, are hereby enjoined and restrained from taking the following actions as to social media companies. They cannot meet with any social media companies for the purpose of urging, encouraging, pressuring, or inducing in any manner the removal, deletion, suppression, or reduction of content containing protective free speech. They cannot specifically flag content or posts on social media platforms or forward anything to social media companies, urging, encouraging, pressuring, or inducing in any manner for removal, deletion, suppression, or reduction of content of protected free speech. They can't urge, encourage, or pressure, blah, 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 any social media companies to change their terms of service for removing those things. They cannot email, call, send letters, text, or engage in any communication of any kind with social media companies that encourages or urges or pressures or induces them to remove content. They cannot collaborate, partner, switchboard, or work with EIP, the Virality Project, the Stanford Internet Observatory, or any project for the purpose of doing the things that they themselves cannot do. I.e. breaking the relationship between the federal government and the NGOs that they are using in their censorship apparatus. They cannot threaten, pressure, or coerce social media companies in any manner to remove, delete, suppress, or reduce posted content of postings containing protective free speech. They can't take any action urging, encouraging, pressuring, or inducing social media companies to remove any content. They can't follow up with social media companies to determine whether the companies removed or deleted anything they had previously asked them to delete. They can't request content reports from social media companies detailing these actions. They can't notify social media companies to be on the lookout for postings containing protected free speech. Those are all the things the government cannot do under this preliminary injunction. Why would the government be upset about that? Oh, national security. Okay, the judge thought one step ahead. The following actions are not prohibited by this injunction: informing social media companies of postings involving criminal activity or conspiracies, contacting social media companies about national security threats, extortion, or other threats, contacting or notifying social media companies about criminal efforts to suppress voting, to provide illegal campaign contributions, of cyber attacks against election infrastructure, or foreign influence operations on elections. They can inform social media companies of threats that threaten the public safety or security of the United States. They can exercise permissible public government speech promoting government policies on views of matters or public concern. You see what they're allowed to do? They can inform social media companies of postings intending to mislead voters about requirements. They can inform or communicate with social media companies in an effort to detect or mitigate malicious cyber activity. And they can communicate with social media companies about deleting, removing, suppressing, or reducing posts on social media platforms that are not protected free speech by the free speech clause in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. That's the judge's order. He is not prohibiting the government from speaking immediately after this is filed. They petition to the Fifth Circuit for an appeal because the government must be able to censor your free speech on social media platforms for it to be able to continue to advance the agenda that they have in mind for everyone. You cannot have a free marketplace of ideas on social media because then people may make different decisions that aren't in lockstep with the regime. They freaked out. They went to the Fifth Circuit. They had a hearing at the Fifth Circuit. I have that hearing for you here. We're going to listen to some of it. We're going to listen to the opening of this. And I want you to see what the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals does. We're going to go a little bit long today, guys. My apologies, but I want to finish this and we're almost done. Here we go. Remember very specifically the language I just read to you in the order, in the order granting the preliminary injunction and the carve out. Here we go. Here is the hearing, August 10th, 2023. This is how long crap takes. State of Missouri v. Biden, en banc, three judges, Fifth Circuit. John Sauer were arguing for the plaintiffs, and Joshua Devine, who you're about to see and hear, arguing for the government.
research showing, despite months of discovery.
Mr. Tenney, you may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Plaintiffs would be entitled to a preliminary injunction in this case if they could demonstrate that a threat directed at conduct by social media companies causing them irreparable injury. They have not made any such showing despite months of discovery. The district court nonetheless entered a preliminary injunction, and that was erroneous for several reasons. The district court exceeded the bounds of a concrete case or controversy under Article 3 and impugned government discussion of issues of public concern. The court's injunction cannot be reconciled with principles of equity and cannot be reconciled with the requirements of Rule 65 of specificity.
I'm just going to stop it real quick. I know the sound isn't the best, but this is the court's recording, so this is the best I can do. I just want to say something. They didn't send their best, okay? If you can't even get through the first paragraph of your prepared statement, and we're going to counter this with John Sauer, who is a brilliant attorney, in just a minute, you have problems. And that's what happened with the government. Here we go.
To give just a few examples, plaintiffs have urged, for example, that if there were a natural disaster and there were untrue statements circulating on social media that were damaging to the public interest, the government would be powerless under the injunction to discourage social media companies from further disseminating those incorrect statements. To take another example.
So if somebody is posting on social media what they consider to be misinformation about a natural disaster, this order would stop the government from telling social media companies to take down the posts. Yeah. Yep, it would. Here.
Plaintiffs urge that if in the course of a law enforcement investigation, a government official were to conclude that it was likely, although not certain, that posts on social media were part of a criminal conspiracy, for example, regarding human trafficking, that the government official would be powerless to bring those posts to the social media companies.
That's not true. And this is the argument they've been making. It would stifle our free speech as the government, and we wouldn't be able to get crimes taken care of. Now watch how quickly.
Attention. These are just some examples.
So you do not believe that either of those are covered by the exception or exclusion specifically contained in the injunction?
Well,
those examples would not be covered by any of the exclusions?
That goes to the Rule 65 problem, Your Honor. We don't know whether they are. The plaintiffs have argued that they're not.
What?
So, at best, that...
Where have they done that? That said your hypos would not be covered?
I believe in the stay opposition, and I think also in their brief.
I think also is not good. If you cannot point to a line and that's an argument you're going to make and you're standing in front of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, you're screwed.
What the government can't do is discourage, you know, the posting on social media. I mean, the exceptions are very unclear. And, you know,
Did the exceptions seem unclear to you? Audience poll.
The carve out for permissible public government speech, plaintiffs have argued in their brief and in their response brief, covers only things that aren't otherwise covered by the injunction. They don't think that carve out does anything at all. We specifically raised the question of whether it was uncertain. They say the district court said that if it was uncertain, then the government can't go after it.
What is he even saying?
So, and these are examples. These are things that they have no standing to challenge, don't cause them irreparable injury, and that are wrong on the merits.
The court said that, or the plaintiffs told you that?
Now, this is the problem. I'm going to explain this to you guys. It doesn't matter what the plaintiff said at this point. They're not arguing against the plaintiffs at this juncture in front of the Fifth Circuit. They're arguing against the judge. They're arguing the judge's order cannot stand for the reasons that they're about to lay out. And they're invoking what's in plaintiff's briefs instead of talking about the order itself and why the order is bad and why the order can't. they did not send their best, which I'm surprised about, actually. I expected the full court all the way up to the DAG.
I'm sorry, who is the they? Who can't go after it? That was confusing.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Sorry.
The plaintiffs, citing the district court's opinion, have said that they construe the injunction to mean that if it is uncertain whether conduct is criminal,
It
is not covered by the...
They could construe it to mean anything they want. It doesn't matter.
Exemption. Now, frankly, I'm not sure whether that's true or not. Our argument in this court is that the injunction is too vague under Rule 65, so I'm not going to tell you that it is or it isn't. That's part of the problem. But the fact that the plaintiffs say that it is illustrates both the vagueness concern and the overbreadth concern and the way those two interact. Now, the problem here, just to be clear, is not just overbreadth and vagueness. It's more fundamental than that. The reason the district court had so much difficulty crafting an injunction is that the district court didn't actually identify specific conduct of the government that would properly be enjoined. The district court took a broad brush approach, saying, you know, finding all sorts of things.
The district court relied on a fact set of 354 pages and over 1,100 paragraphs to carefully write an 155-page memorandum accompanying this order. So,
things that the government did that it didn't like, and then recognizing presumably that was too broad, then started trying to carve things out. But that's not that's wrong in a way more fundamental than just crafting an injunction. That's wrong because what the district court should have been doing is looking for specific things that the government was doing, targeting specific actions by social media companies, causing irreparable injury to these plaintiffs. And if it found any, it could enjoin those.
But it found them. It found all of them. All the ones it enjoined. Now.
We disagree with, you know, some of the statements in here. We don't think this is good policy. And the district court said that's unconstitutional. Now, that just...
scenes in the future elections.
Hold on.
All state government people make posts all the
epicenter of dissent.
Here we go.
We don't...
You're going to have to excuse his voice. It's a little bit hard to hear, to listen to.
You're talking about the future.
You personally, but the federal...
Hold on. I want you to compare and contrast here.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, John Sauer of Louisiana, on behalf of all the plaintiffs' appellees, and then my colleague from Missouri, Mr. Devine, I think will address the court for 5 minutes after I do. I want to start by asking the court to imagine a scenario where senior White House staffers contact the book publishers, you know, Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble in the United States, and they tell them, we want to have a book burning program, and we want to help you implement this book burning program. We want to identify for you the books that we want burned, and by the way, the books that we want burned are the books that criticize the administration and its policies. And suppose they said, we want to be partners in this book burning effort, and when they didn't get the cooperation they wanted, for example, one time they said, hey, here's 12 authors we want you to pull off the shelves and burn. These are the really bad ones. You got to burn those books. And the booksellers probably said, well, we don't really want to do that. Then 2 days later, the White House press secretary was at the podium and said, these booksellers need to burn more books. And the president supports a robust antitrust program to go after them. So they need to do more to go after these books. And later they started sending emails that contained implied threatening communications like, oh, you haven't burned enough books. You haven't let us help you identify the books we want you to burn, and therefore internally we're considering our options about what to do about it. And when they lose their temper, they use the F-bomb against the booksellers. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of July of 2021, there is a 1-2-3 public punch where the White House press secretary and the Surgeon General stand at the podium and they say, these books are poison, and we are going to hold you accountable, a word that the district court expressly found carries with it the threat of consequences for letting these books be on your shelves. And then a few days later, the White House communications secretary also goes public and she says, we're just exploring legal liability against you because you haven't burned enough books. And we're looking at repealing a piece of legislation that gives you a huge subsidy worth billions of dollars if you don't burn more books. And then suppose all the booksellers decided the game wasn't worth a candle and they started complying. And that's exactly what you see here in the record here. In July of 2021, you see the platforms having resisted, you know, the White House pressure for a significant significant period of time. They complied on a number of issues, but they're holding out on certain issues. And all of a sudden, after there's those public threats combined with the private pressure campaign that had lasted for months and months, you see the platforms just giving in. And you see them essentially from then on agreeing with whatever the White House and the Surgeon General demanded on those.
You get the picture. This argument goes on. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals rules in favor of the injunction. They uphold the preliminary injunction, but, and they withhold the, I have to put some things in the show notes because it's very important. In their written order, the Fifth Circuit acknowledges the fact that these social media companies are likely tainted forever. There's a lot of amazing free speech arguments in this hour and a half long hearing. It is very well worth your time to listen to. I implore you guys to listen to it. Again, show notes below. It's an amazing, amazing display here in this courtroom on this. They order that because they say in their order that because the government has intervened in how the social media companies craft their terms of service, that those terms of service are now forever tainted by the government. It is something to behold. They hold in favor. However, they removed CISA from the temporary injunction. And when they removed CISA, we were like, what? And there were people on social media all happy about this, unaware of the nuance. Unaware of the nuance of it. CISA is the backbone of the censorship enterprise. Removing CISA is like crippling the entire case at its knees. And we were upset about it. So what did the attorneys for the plaintiffs do? Missouri, Louisiana, private plaintiffs. They went back in and they asked the Fifth Circuit to reconsider their decision and to add CISA back on. And that's very rare that a court will reconsider an order they made and change it after it's been decided. The Fifth Circuit reconsidered and added CISA back. I get a little bit emotional about this case in a way sometimes because it truly is the first time in a long time that the American citizen, no matter the color, the sex, the gender, whatever, the American citizen's rights have been upheld in a court of law over the absolutely Orwellian censorship machine that is the federal government. And that censorship has effects on us far outside of just muzzling us so we can't speak. You know, in this hearing, Sauer says, I was discussing this case on YouTube with a panel, and I was banned from YouTube for discussing this very case. It's 9:33. I can do a little bit more on this appeal, but at the end of the day, like I said, ultimately, the court came back, reconsidered, added CISA back on, and immediately, the arguments made by the government in this hearing are so stunning and so brazen and so antithetical to everything we stand for in this country that it is terrifying. It's terrifying. I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm not being ridiculous. This case was appealed to the Supreme Court by the government saying they can't stop us. We have to be able to censor Americans. That's their argument. We must be able to censor Americans. It's for everybody's safety, you see. And the Supreme Court did something absolutely unspeakable. So odd, actually, in fact, it prompted a 4-page statement from the justices who disagreed with what the rest of the court did. They didn't read the record. They didn't read the fact set. And they stayed the injunction until the case is heard. Meaning, The government is free to trample over everybody's rights in perpetuity. Until the Supreme Court can hear this and make a decision on the temporary injunction. So, anybody who comes out and tells you that the Supreme Court is ruling on this case as a whole is misinformed. This hearing on Monday of next week, which I'm going to be live streaming, will be on this temporary injunction, not on the case as a whole. And I want to read to you what the judges who dissented say. There are briefs filed by, you know, states hopping in and Congress hopping in. And, you know, as a matter of fact, the Weaponization Committee added stuff to the record in this case in a brief that was like the Facebook files that they released and a whole bunch of other stuff that just slammed the government. I mean, slammed them. And the Fifth Circuit used that in their decision. I'm just looking for it. I have the whole timeline here. The whole timeline. Everything that's happened. Hold on. I have a thread about it. Three judges dissented. They say that they fear that the decision to stay this is the dissenters. I think it's Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, if I'm not mistaken. They say it does not appear that any of the government's hypothetical communications would actually be prohibited by the injunction, nor is any such example provided by the court's unreasoned order. The government claims the injunction might prevent the president and senior officials who serve as his proxies from speaking to the public on matters of public concern. The president himself is not subject to the injunction, and in any event, the injunction doesn't prevent any government official from speaking on any matter or from urging any entity or person to act in accordance with their view of responsible conduct. It only applies when the government crosses the line and begins to coerce or control others' exercise of free speech rights. Does the government think that the First Amendment allows executive branch officials to engage in such conduct? Does it have plans for this to occur between now and the time when the case was decided? The Supreme Court is refuting in this dissent the argument of the government already before they even hear it. I threaded the entire thing out. This is what SCOTUS ends with. At this time in the history of our country, what the court has done, I fear, will be seen as some as giving the government a green light to use heavy-handed tactics to skew the presentation of views on the medium that increasingly dominates the dissemination of news. That is most unfortunate. We have waited since October for this hearing on Monday. And Monday it happens. When a decision comes after that, I don't know. But the hearing is Monday. And I am going to bring it to you live. So now, if you've paid attention to the past 2 hours and 15 minutes of shows, you are generally, without getting too much into the minutiae and the fact pattern, up to date on Missouri v. Biden. So that when this happens on Monday, and your friends are all out there, you can inform them about this case, its implications, what it means, and what it means moving forward for us as Americans and our right to free speech, and what the government can and cannot do to take that right away from us. In closing, you can find a detailed analysis on all of this. I mean detailed. If you want to be a law nerd for a day, on my social media and at Uncover DC. It is one of the most important stories I've covered ever. I am glad that I sensed when this was first filed how important it would be. And I never, ever, ever do this, but I'm going to do it today. It is so important. We are not funded by anybody other than you guys. Straight up. We're not behind a paywall. Nothing you ever have to pay for in terms of information. And I am happy to have it stay that way. But we need your help. I never do fundraising. I'm not one of those people. I'm just not. But I'm doing it today. If you can support Uncover DC and the work we're doing to bring information like this to you that very few other people do, and I'm confident in saying that, you can go to uncoverdc.com and click on support. Let me show it to you. Hold on. I'm going to link everything below for you so that you'll have it and you can use it and share it with your friends. But if you click here on support, you find all the options to support us. It is so important. And again, I probably am woefully inept at doing this. Everybody else does it every day, and I never do it. But make today the day that you decide to buy us a coffee at Uncover DC. It would be really, really helpful and greatly appreciated. Even though I had a very kind and generous offer from a viewer and a listener and a good friend to come and stay with them so that I could get up to DC to see this, I can't go. And I should be able to go to the it's too late now, so don't, you know, whatever. But I can't go. So I appreciate you guys. Reese, God bless you. Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys. And we'll be back with Frank on Friday. Off we go.